ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
That powerful voice belongs to a 9-year-old girl named Danielle Denise, who in 1988 became the youngest ever performer to win the prize for Discovery of the Year on the hugely popular TV show Young Talent Time. Now that little girl is one of the world's great opera singers with a voice of stunning power, precision and clarity. Isn't that fabulous? Danielle Denise singing Alcina from her 2018 album of Handel arias. Danielle lives in a huge, very famous house in England, and she's home in Oz to star as the character whom Opera Australia are billing as the most dangerous woman in opera. So let's learn about the journey that's taken Danny Denise to performing in the great opera houses of the world and discover what she makes of the woman who she's now playing on stage, the notorious Carmen. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. What a lovely introduction.
You left the city of your birth, Melbourne, when you were just a little...
Yes, I was 10. It was just after I won Young Talent Time, actually.
What did they give you on Young Talent Time?
They gave me a Yamaha grand piano, which I still have.
A baby grand?
Yeah, and it's travelled the world. It's gone to LA, it's gone to New York, and now it lives in England, and it's in fantastic condition, and they gave me $5,000.
Well, that was a lot of money.
Yes, it absolutely was.
Still a lot of money.
It was amazing. It was an amazing thing to win at that age.
So you're a Melbourne girl. You grew up in Glen Waverley,
yes,
which I think of as quite a respectable suburb.
I think it was, yeah. I had a lovely childhood, very lovely Aussie, wonderful,
lots of bikes,
childhood.
Bike riding.
Bikes, skateboarding.
Cubby houses.
Cubby houses. I mean, I tell my kids about cubby houses and I notice that all the English children don't call it that, but mine do.
What do English children call it?
I think they call it den making.
How marvellous. So, Mum and Dad are Beverly and Chris.
That's right.
And they're Sri Lankan burghers.
That's right.
I don't know what that means.
So, Sri Lanka was colonised by the British, the Dutch and the Portuguese over 400 years. And there are people in Sri Lanka who have the mixed European ancestry and they are called the burgher population, B-U-R-G-H-E-R, so the Dutch word. I think in the most heyday of the Sri Lankan burghers, they made up 5% of the population, and I think it's a much smaller percentage now. When the British left Sri Lanka and the language went back to Sinhalese, the burgher population, whose mother tongue was English, many went away to Commonwealth countries where they had more of their cultural upbringing, so England, Canada, and Australia.
Right.
And that's where my parents met. It's such a uniquely small percentage of the population. And I have met a few people. So Michael Ondaatje, who wrote The English Patient, is a Sri Lankan Dutch burgher, same as me.
A fellow burgher?
Yes. Like a Dutch name, like Denise,
yeah.
Ondaatje is a Dutch name as well. But yeah, there's not a lot of us around.
Do you remember what the first piece that you sang in public was? I mean, I'm sure you sang in the lounge room. But the first time you got up in front of an audience and sang...
I think the very first thing that I sang was Green Door. Green Door, dun 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 na na, Green Door. It's a popular song. It was in a dance concert, a song and dance concert at Tony Bartuccio's School of Dance.
Tony
one of the best schools in Melbourne. Yeah, it was absolutely
amazing.
Did
you study at Tony Bartuccio's School of Dance?
I totally did, yeah.
The man with the whitest teeth in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah,
and
my parents...
jackets.
Yeah, they sought out all the best teachers. I remember other kids going to different teachers and my parents going, no, you're going to Tony Bartuccio, he's the best.
Yeah.
Finding the best teachers for me at every turn.
And you played piano, obviously, because someone gave you, well, the people at the television station gave you a baby grand.
Yeah, and I luckily did play piano, although I do remember that in the clip, they suddenly, Johnny Young put me in front of the piano and he said, play something.
And be quick, he said.
And I thought, oh my, I didn't know that was going to happen. And I think I said something like, in a very, Australian accent, I don't know what to play.
Show business is obviously in you. So your parents they're encouraging all this, obviously. No one's saying this idea that you're going to be an opera singer. Well, we haven't established that you were going to be an opera singer. You're going to be a singer.
Yes.
When did the opera bit kick in?
Amazingly, it happened the same year that I won Young Talent Time. I'd been doing all this song and dance. I'd done ballet, jazz, tap, modern. I was doing lots of different things and singing. And I was at Johnny Young Talent School as well. I think somewhere within all of that, all of the teachers were saying to my parents, you know, she's unusually talented for someone so young, or we're putting her in the adult classes, or we're giving her first place in the iStudfords. Like, you know, this sort of thing was happening. And my parents had this amazing clarity of thought. And I think they thought to themselves, we don't want her to be pulled from pillar to post, just winging it, pulled around doing this and that, and have nothing solid to lean upon in terms of a technique. So they thought, why don't we find her a classical teacher who'll teach her? And it was not easy to find a teacher. I think most people would have agreed she should just wait till she's older.
Well, there's this whole idea that you've got to allow your voice to mature to a certain level before you start training it to
before
do the
you
opera
even
thing.
Assess whether you should do the opera thing. But they persevered, and my mum found me a teacher who I reunited with when I came for my Opera Australia debut in 2017, called Amanda Colliver, who's Melbourne-based. And she said, I will take her on. And at 8 years old, I started doing the Kai scales and the Viardot exercises. It's a type of technique. And I was singing Bach. I was singing Haydn. I was singing things that I loved. I mean, the thing is, my parents were very all-rounders with their music. So we listened to classical music. I remember listening to Kathleen Battle and Christopher Parkening on the guitar and her album, or Jesse Norman's album. But I also remember ABBA, and I remember Peter, Paul and Mary. I had a really broad musical atmosphere. And
so Jesse Norman's a famous soprano, or mezzo.
Mezzo, that's right. And Kathleen Battle, also a famous soprano.
Peter, Paul and Mary were folk singers of
And then, you know, Les Mis Cass album with, you know, Michael Ball, who I then have gone on to sing with. And so during that time, when I took those lessons, I didn't articulate it the way I can now, but I know how I felt. I thought, all my friends who are singers, all of them can sing and dance and act. They can all be like in a musical, but none of them can do this. And I sort of recognized in myself this special quality of what it was to produce a classical sound. Reflecting now, years and years later, I had parents who saw what was there, nurtured what was there, especially my mom, who was like my first teacher and everything, and who found me that classical teacher, but saw that I loved it so much, they couldn't look away. They felt like a moral obligation to help me continue because I wanted it.
Pushy. They weren't pushy. Because that's what we all fear, that you're a little girl with pushy showbiz parents.
100%. And I met some of those people in the iStudfords circuit. I remember them,
those
certain people's
of
mums and stuff like that. And I just had this amazing balance. So, like, I did. I remember seeing a picture of me holding an iStudfords medal and being photographed outside my house in Glen Waverley. But then I think I went on to have my 10th birthday fancy dress party. So I was still, like, allowed to be a child. I was allowed to skateboard. I was allowed to get my spokey dokes and go riding all around Glen Waverley.
You say that, but in 1990 you left at the age of 11.
Yeah.
To go to the USA.
That's a big thing my parents decided to do, isn't it?
Did they get jobs? How did all this work?
Yeah, they got jobs eventually, but at first it was a sort of, it was a trip, it was an exploratory holiday and trip to see what opportunities there might be while we were on holiday. So it was an amazing thing that happened. They wrote to a lot of the schools here in Australia, having won all the iStudfords up to age 18, they sought, you know, the Victorian College of the Arts, and there wasn't any under 18 divisions at that time in Australia for talented kids. So, you know, the College of the Arts, I think, told them she just has to wait it out now till she's 18.
Tell the girl to wait.
Yeah. And they wrote to the American conservatories, and the American conservatories all said, oh, we're very interested. Send her to live with us. Send her, we'll put her with a host family, and we'll enroll her in the pre-uni.
So you went to America planning just for a holiday.
Yeah, as far as I can remember, yeah.
But you stayed, didn't you?
Yeah, it was like one big adventure for us. What are my memories of that year? I mean, it was, I got scouted for a Disney commercial, I think, just out of the blue. My parents found a conservatory called the Colburn School that would take me on, that said, we will train her. We will continue her training at this moment.
Right.
We'll, and in fact, they didn't even have a voice department, but they made one for me.
If you make your professional debut, I think at the age of 19, is that right, at the Metropolitan Opera in New York?
Yeah, first was my operatic debut was at age 15 in a world premiere at Los Angeles Opera. And so it was, again, another one of those sort of, I did a few wild things. I mean, I made my recital debut at like 12. I did my opera debut at 15. I won an Emmy when I was 16.
Because you were hosting a television show for kids.
Yeah, I mean, that was another wild one. I mean, I was just, our school was featured, and then I was featured as LA Kid of the Week on the show called LA Kids. And then the producer saw me and she said, oh, I think you need to come. I think you should be a child guest host, because she had an adult guest host.
This ridiculous story is being told to us by Danny Denise, a wonderful opera singer who's back in her hometown of Melbourne to perform Carmen. So you're married to Gus Christie, whose family has, They own an opera house. They've got this big, you've got this big country house in Sussex, and there's this opera house there, which in fact I think is the second version of the opera house. How did you get involved with all of this, with the Christies and Glyndebourne? Because we've been in America so far.
That's right. Well, after making my debut at the Metropolitan Opera when I was 19, I did the Young Artist Program there and left at, I think, 21 or 22, I think, to go and make my European debut as Cleopatra at the Netherlands Opera. And that really started my career rolling in a different direction, suddenly doing all these Baroque grand dames. That led to me going to Paris and, you know, Amsterdam. I was everywhere. And then I went to Glyndebourne a year early to play Cleopatra. I was scheduled to do Die Fledermaus, and there Cleopatra got ill.
That's another sort of fairy story, isn't it? Now, not all Australians will know about Glyndebourne, because it's a very English institution. I actually saw my very first opera at Glyndebourne.
Did
you? Yeah, in 1973. I was a schoolboy. I was 17. I just finished school. And I had a very posh friend who lived in England. And they said, we're going to the opera. Have you got some nice clothes? And I had some all right clothes. And we went off. It was so exciting. We drove to the countryside and there was this big house with this opera house. It was ridiculous. And it was Death in Venice by Benjamin Britten, which now know was this iconic production, and it was my introduction to opera. And I was completely smitten.
That's a fantastic introduction to opera.
But I was also smitten by the poshness of it. I think we all had sort of picnics in the car park and stuff. Is that still a thing?
Yes, it's absolutely still the way that John and Audrey envisioned it 90 years ago.
So John and Audrey are your...
So John is John Christie, and Audrey Mildmay is his wife. John Christie had the family home, the country pile of Glyndebourne House, and he was passionate about opera. So he would put on these soirees where he would do opera scenes, a little like salon, if you will. And he was a complete eccentric, a very, very, I think, charming, delightful British eccentric. He was a captain in the war, but he loved opera. He bought a building firm so that they would build him an organ room, and he bought an organ building firm so that they would build the organ. So he contributed so much to the local economy anyway, but he loved opera. And it was while putting on one of these soirees, they would invite some professionals to come in and do some of the parts that they couldn't do. And Audrey Mildmay came in one day and he fell in love with her. And they married.
She's a singer.
Yeah, she was a soprano. And they married, and he thought, I want to build a theatre for you. And she has famously said, oh, for goodness sake, John, if you're going to do it, you must do it properly. And so Glyndebourne was made. The Glyndebourne Theatre was built in the proverbial backyard.
Right. So you're now the lady of this house, are you?
Yeah, so John passed the festival on to his son George, and George handed the festival over to his son Gus in 2000. So when I came to sing Cleopatra in 2005, I was part of a very now iconic show. I equate that show to like when Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet did Titanic, because things just went to sort of unbelievable heights after that in my career from making a splash in this all singing, all dancing role. It was the kind of role that I think people thought, you were born to do this role on that show with the skills that you had from those days in Australia, from starting here at six with jazz and ballet and tap. And all of a sudden, all these skills came into this perfect alchemy.
You're painting a very fresh vision of opera, because if you stand outside opera, it's such an over-the-top art form, often very melodramatic, with, you know, with pure-hearted sopranos or broken-hearted sopranos soaring like birds and villainous basses who appear in a puff of smoke with maniacal laughter. And if you love that kind of thing, it's tremendous. But if you stand outside of it, you think, this is very silly, very melodramatic. Why do people fall for this?
You have just touched upon, Michael, like, what is my whole purpose in life? Because it is one of the things that I really, truly seek every time I get on stage to thwart, which is that idea that when you see something of operatic proportions, that it can't be rooted in dramatic intensity and reality. So we have this thing that because things are so elevated in the operatic musical idiom that when not performed authentically as a piece of theatre, people can go, well, that was hardly believable. But anyway, it's opera. That's what happens. They fall in love in 5 minutes, you know.
The retort, Danny, is the reason I'm striking this melodramatic pose with my palm on my forehead gazing tragically into the distance is because I have to sing. And if I'm going to leap about and do naturalistic acting, I'll run out of breath. So really, it's about the singing, and that shouldn't be compromised by the physical exertions that are required to act. That's
100%.
That's the argument, isn't it?
That's the dilemma that all opera singers will face. And I guess, like, one of the things that I love to believe when it comes to opera is that one can have all the largesse and majesty of sound and vocal production. You know, it's a massive endeavor to study the technique of classical singing. But inside of all of that is the very first thing that inspired the musical composition in the first place, which is the text. And one of the things I take such delight in doing is taking even things that might seem sort of outlandish as a plot story, because opera does have some outlandish plot stories, and tethering them to something that is truly authentic as an actor, so that people, I hope, won't leave the theatre feeling that anything that happened, from my character anyway, was not believable. And that's not an easy thing to accomplish. It's the sort of Everest of opera, in my view, because you do have all of those other things that you mentioned, these elements that are absolutely crucial, the vocal production, the sound. But I love to always try each and every time I get on stage to not let those priorities supersede the dramatic intensity of the emotional word. And what I'm saying is only worth anything. It's only worth getting my sound around that because of the emotion that propels it. But it's not an easy thing.
This is The Stage Show on Radio National, and you're meeting this marvellous woman, Danny Denise, who's in Australia, back in the country of her birth, to sing the role of Carmen with Australian Opera, back here from England, where she's now based. So you and the Australian director, Anne Louis-Sachs, are starting afresh, I guess, with the opera Carmen, because this is a new version for Opera Australia. So, what happens at Opera Australia is they get a production, and they do it for years and years and years. It's kind of in repertory, and then it's all kept in a big shed somewhere, and every now and then someone says, let's do Carmen again, and they get all the scenery out and all the cozies out, and they mount it again. And there's nothing wrong with that. There are some beautiful productions that have been in the repertoire for years and years and years. But this is a new production of Carmen, and it's an opera that's famous because it's about ordinary people. Up until then, operas tend to be about gods or princes or lords or whatnot. But here you've got a tragedy of ordinary people. Carmen's a factory worker, and the other group are soldiers. So the soldiers have come to town, basically, and these are people who will never achieve independence. They'll always be subject to the orders of other people of a higher class.
Yes.
Am I reading all this into? Was this part? Is this important to the way you're thinking about the opera?
Important. Very important.
So how does that fact play into who Carmen is, how she is in the world, her class status?
Well, one of the things that Anne-Louise has done with this production is bring it straight up into the modern day. But she hasn't shaved off any of the traditional ethos of the piece simply because it's in the modern time. I think one of the things that makes Carmen so timeless is the fact that you can actually take this story right up into today and you have the same issues that women face and that men face and that families face and that displaced people face. So there's a lot of different elements to the story. Carmen is absolutely, as you described, she's a woman of the people. She's a woman very grounded in the earth. She's very in touch with herself. But I think the thing that makes her different is how she wears her spirit. And I think she wears it very close to the surface and very much reaching out and grabbing the world around her. This is the thing that I love about Carmen. And it's the thing that I have to say, when I've seen Carmen's, the two words that I often see portrayed for Carmen is like sexy and enigmatic. Like they do the very cool, the elusive, you know, you don't know how amazing I am because I'm Carmen.
Yes.
And
is that wrong?
Well,
I kind of like that stuff.
I went into Carmen going, okay, well, because I've been asked to do Carmen for years years and years. And all my fans, basically, fan people, just going, when are you going to do it? And I'd always say, I'm a soprano, so I probably won't do Carmen. You know, my voice has now evolved and it's brought me to a place where I am in the perfect vocal evolution for Carmen. Right. But I read the novel, so I came in thinking, okay, well, that people want to see that, and I've done all these amazing characters like Cleopatra and Poppaea and, you know, Rosalind and all these sort of very big female characters. So I thought that might be what people want to see me for Carmen as. But when I read the novel, I was illuminated by so many different qualities than what I've seen in Carmen on stage. She was not at all closed and cool and distant and alluring, but enigmatic from afar. She was someone with her eyes wide open, someone who enjoys people around her. I mean, I'm lurching out like that. I don't mean to sort of like come off my chair, but she was not at all how I've seen her portrayed. There's a great moment in the novel where she sort of talks to the narrator, and then as soon as she's interested, she puts her dress down and she's talking. But she's not putting her dress down to be sexy. It's a gesture of like openness. It's a gesture of curiosity. And yes, it's alluring, but she's not pulling away from people to be alluring. And I just found that much more complex and nuanced than the sexy enigma Carmen.
Yeah. What about the sort of wild side of her? I mean, soon after the opera begins, she knifes another girl in the factory, doesn't she?
Well, I think that's debatable, Michael. You know, I'm totally kidding. You know, there's a fight. But of course, when the girls come out to talk about it, there's actually half of the girls are on Carmen's side as well. So it's a little he said, she said, if you will.
Right. So there's been a knife fight in the factory.
There's been a bit of goading. And I think that goading leads to some violence. Now, whether Carmen provoked it or whether Carmen was defending herself, right, I think is debatable. I think that we leave to how the staging comes to life in the room.
Is it important to you that you're on Carmen's side as a performer?
Yes.
So
yes.
Is it possible
that
I...
You can see that in my eyes.
Yeah, I can. Is it possible that I, as a member of the audience, will see Carmen not quite the way you present her to me, that I will say, but she's cruel? So what happens is she's arrested for this affray, but she basically flirts with a very hapless soldier called Don José, who is supposed to arrest her, but he kind of lets her go. He gets popped in jail for a bit because he's done the wrong thing. And later on, she sort of seduces him and says, basically, come with me. Don't worry about the bell that's calling or the bugle that's calling you back to barracks. Come with me. And he goes and he throws away his career. And then she gets tired of him and drops him. And you think, gosh, you're a dangerous person.
Yeah.
You're looking at me like I'm a poor sop who doesn't understand what's really going on.
Oh, no, not at all. It's all there. And this is the thing, is like, that's the thing I look forward to, is when I came to create this with Anne-Louise, we had that. That's the plot. We had that. And we were like both asking ourselves the question, is this what it is? Or are there other nuances to it? So picking apart some of those things, José was always really annoyed with her when she was imprisoned. And then she's sort of like, oh, let me go. And he's sort of like, shut up, I don't want to let you go. And then 2 seconds later, he goes, Carmen, if I let you go, if I love you, would you love me back? And I always looked at that in opera and just thought, okay, well, that's not very believable. I don't buy that, sorry.
Oh, you think he's the predator?
No, it's more like how you can convince an audience of something is entirely dependent on how you thread your character together. So when I would watch that and think it was unbelievable, it wasn't because I wanted to create a predator in José. It was more just like, that hasn't been drawn well, because now I don't believe that he can switch so quickly to be in love. This is what I think makes, I'm not saying this because I'm in it, this is what I think makes our Carmen so rich, is because Anne-Louise and I both agreed that we're not going to go, okay, well, if this is what it says it is, this is what it is, so let's just do that, because that's what people do. We've sort of broken it apart and questioned every one of those corners and said, is that believable? And how can we make it believable? And so we've made a staging that I think makes it much more believable that their chemistry could smolder so quickly. I mean, we're talking 2 minutes. You know, for example, in the Habanera, we plant seeds with José there so that it's not just him capturing a person and then falling in love with her in 2 minutes. We actually have made it. I feel like we've argued for theater in such a, I'm excited just telling you about it, because we've argued for this theatrical piece actually being totally plausible.
This is such an exciting conversation. And as we wind up, Danny, I can really see how you have been on this journey from being that 9-year-old girl singing in that strong, defiant voice that cut through the air to this moment. It's as though all these pieces in your life sort of converge into, well, this moment, and presumably in the next performance and the next show, you'll put them together in a different way. But it feels as though you're just being your truest self.
It's what I really feel, that all of the moments of my life, all the variety that my career has entailed, from doing things on the West End or Broadway, opera, the Met, La Scala, coming back to Sydney Opera House for my debut here, I feel like it's all kind of come together in what for me is a really career-defining moment, is making this shift from the artist I've been up to now to Carmen. And I feel in a way there'll be like me before I did Carmen and there'll be me after I did Carmen. So to come back to Australia, my home country, to create this role. And, you know, you mentioned the fact that it's pulled out for years and years. And I sort of thought, gulp, you know, because there's so much pressure that comes with that as well. Knowing that you're leaving.
You're creating the role.
Yeah, you're leaving something that will be done for years and years and years. But I feel utterly privileged to be able to do that with this company, because I adore Opera Australia as a company from top to bottom. The members, the singers, the performers, the dancers, the production staff, the crew, they're very, very dear to me.
Listener, I know you're saying don't wind this up, but there are other people we have to talk to. Danielle, thank you so much.
You are so lovely. Thank you, Michael, for having me.
You've been meeting the Australian-born soprano, Danielle Denise, a huge international star, back in the city where she was born, to star in the Australian Opera's brand new production of Carmen, directed by Anne-Louise Sarkes. You can see it at the beautiful Regent Theatre in Melbourne through until the 25th of November. On RN, this is The Stage Show with Michael Cathcart. It's 1883, and we're in a lonesome town in the American Wild West, where a fair while ago, the men all ran off to join the gold rush, and the women folk are left to carry on without them, and they're starting to fear that the men have all died. But their suspense, their unease, their sense of what is normal is upended when a charismatic bandit swaggers into the saloon and triggers a gender explosion. Across the town, some women, and I think the soul man, the local sheriff, undergo well, a kind of frenzy of gender revision. That's the driver of a chaotic, funny, heartfelt play called Cowboys, spelt C-O-W-B-O-I-S. It's by the UK writer Charlie Josephine, and it was first performed at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Now it's coming to the Seymour Centre in Sydney in a production by the Siren Theatre Company. Actors Jules Billington and Clay Crichton are in our Sydney studios right now. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
And also Zachary Alexander and Nelson Fannin, who are musicians, yeah? Is that how it works?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.
What musicians have we got in the room there? Just give us a little sound.
Bit of banjo.
Bit of banjo there.
Then we got a bit of acoustic guitar.
Nelson on the guitar.
Yep.
And I'm playing violin.
Bit of fiddle there. Yeah.
Just put it down on the ground.
So when the audience walks into the theatre, the space there in Sydney, what are they confronted with? Where's this all happening?
So we're playing this at the Reginald Theatre at the Seymour Centre, but we're creating two liminal worlds stacked on top of each other. So we are simultaneously in the 1800s in the Midwest of the United States of America, and we're also in 2025 in Sydney on the corner of City Road and Cleveland Street at the Seymour Centre. And the joy of this production is to speak in our own voices. And so we're not doing the US accent thing. We're able to kind of access a deeper truth through using our own voices. But when you do walk into the theatre, you are going to see it transformed by the amazing design from Amelia Simcox. Basically, she's created this huge moving painting of her costumes and this incredibly hand-painted curtain that drops down as part of kind of the big reveal in the show. And it's, you know, it's real. You know, the wood that is in the set for the bar is real wood. The glass is real. The musicians on stage are real. Yeah. And so you get really immersed in it. And for a few lucky people, you can buy tickets to sit with us on the stage. Mm. So that is the hot tip in town, Michael.
So, Jules, let's flesh out this story. You play the swaggering Jack Cannon.
That I do.
Wanted in 14 counties.
Of the state, correct. Perjury, bigamy, a long list of crimes. Very handsome. Dark past this Jack Cannon.
And a very handsome dude.
They do.
Can we use the word dude?
We do, yes. He, him pronouns for Jack.
And who are the other main characters we need to get our head around to understand what's going on?
Well, you've listed a couple, but the main lady of the town is the bar publican, Miss Lillian, played by the utterly extraordinarily Emily Cascarino. Then we've also got our lone male figure in town, the sheriff, played by Matt Abatomi. And then we've got a fabulous chorus of other women and currently expressed as women folk. And as part of this gender revolution that Jack Cannon kind of swaggers into town with, people discover the truth of who they are. So it's not just about people discovering they may have a slightly broader gender identity. It's about people discovering their autonomy, their personal expression, what it is that makes them vibrant and tick and flourish in life. And if you take my opinion, Charlie Josephine, he's an extraordinary playwright who has kind of put in really weighty societal issues around patriarchy and autonomy and all of those things, but he's thrown them in the guise of a Western, which is incredibly fun and joyous and frivolous, and it means that anyone who's anyone can access this story.
I was going to say, I was fearing I was going to be preached at when I read the script, but the script is funny.
It is hilarious.
And it's joyful, and it's full of very, they're sort of musical characters, but they have heart.
They do. They do. Yeah. It's a really rich, joyous experience where Charlie just simply wanted to tell a story at the centre of it, where a genderqueer person's story and their hopes and their dreams is just something that's joyful. Too often we paint the picture of the trans identity as something that is full of kind of woe and suffering, and that's not to undercut the fact that you can sometimes have a difficult experience being a trans person, but it's worth creating art that celebrates the joy and the life and the euphoria and the power of what it is to have a loving trans story.
That all comes through, yeah. I mean, it's full of mischief and fun and affection, this play. So, Clay, you're a violinist, as
I am, yes.
And you've written the original music for this production. How have you approached that?
Well, the piece that we will play for you today is actually the first piece that I wrote for it. And it kind of honestly just stemmed from there. The music is really indicative of this change that Jules was talking about and so eloquently put.
So it's a song sung by who? Who are the performers we're about to hear? What the characters, I mean, in this song?
This doesn't really have a particular place in the actual play itself, even though throughout the stage directions there's lots of, and the band plays something here and the band does this here. This is actually something that we'll be playing as folks come in. And it was, yeah, of my own imagination, thinking about the townsfolk, the men of the town, rather, that have left and gone to find gold to take back to their wives and their misses, and just dreaming about going back to them and going back to home.
So we can't make sense of this song without knowing the big reveal of the second half, is that the men come home and find that the whole town has been upended and their wives are now discovering, expressing different genders and different affections. And is that right?
You could say that.
That's it. Yeah.
I guess I'd phrase it more that act one is where the women get to rewrite their own rules. Mm, mm. And what you discover in act two when the men arrive back in town is that the men have had all the voice. And the men have chosen the rules for everyone, which isn't necessarily fair. And so, you know, we get to see these women grow into their own voices, stand up and speak for themselves. And it's done with humour and it's done with sort of a lighthearted touch. And it's kind of, that's the charm of the play, that by the end of the play, everyone has kind of learnt to embrace their individuality, including the men, which is
fabulous.
But have
I got this right? The voice we're going to hear now is the men.
Yeah. We begin with their, you know, out on the gold rush, dreaming about what it'll be like, that victory of finding gold and taking it back to their wives and fiancés. And then we'll plunge into the lives of the women as the curtain goes up and the lights come on and the play begins.
Let's hear the men's take on this.
I left my girl, I left her for a better world, to get some money so I can take it home. I said I'll miss you sorely, and if it wasn't for us being poorly, I'd stay by your side till the day I die. Take me back to the girl that I love. Take me back to the town that I'm dreaming of. There's supposed to be a gold rush, but there's nothing fuss about it. I try to keep my head up, but I'd rather be without it, 'cause the aching in my body ain't got nothing on this old heart. Since I left town and left my girl, I've missed her from the start. Take me back to the girl that I love. Take me back to the town that I'm that I love. Take me back to the town that I'm dreaming of.
Those men are in for a big surprise. That's Zachary Alexander, Nelson Fannin, accompanying Jules Billington and Clay Crichton, all playing and singing there together. That's the chorus of the men who are about to come home and discover that things are not as they left them in town. Well, chuckles to all of you, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Clay Crichton, Jules Billington, Zachary Alexander and Nelson Fannin. Cowboys, it's called. It's on at the Regional Theatre at Sydney Seymour Centre from the 20th of November through until the 13th of December in this year of our Lord, 2025. I had to think for a moment there. This is The Stage Show. I'm Michael Cathcart. The South African writer Athol Fugard was a massively influential playwright. His plays touched the consciences and the lives of audiences and theatre makers all over the world, from the 1970s through to the fall of South Africa's racist apartheid system in 1994. Well, in March this year, Athol Fugard died at the grand age of 92. And soon afterwards, I spoke about him with Anthony Ackerman, who is an award-winning South African playwright and screenwriter. And Fugard's been part of Anthony's world since the 1960s. So let's remember Fugard or find out who he was. Hello, Anthony. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Michael. Good to hear you.
Tell us about the very first time that you saw Athol Fugard in person. I think you were at university studying theatre.
That's right. Yes, I was a first-year drama student doing drama and English as my majors. And, of course, you were then immediately confronted with some very boring classics, you know, medieval mystery plays and Roman comedies that are not very funny. And then one of my lecturers was a friend of Athol Fugard's, and he talked about this new play that had been put on in 1969, it was. It was called Busman and Leona. And I was mildly interested. And then during the university vacation, I was in Durban, which is my hometown, and it was playing at the University Theatre. And I went along to see it. And it was one of those red-letter days. It completely changed my perception of theatre. It was the most riveting piece of theatre that I'd seen. Very relevant, very South African. And that, I suppose, in Australia, you've had the same thing when, for a long time, you had imported theatre, you know, players from Britain or America. And it was probably only around about the time with David Williamson and during the Gough Whitlam era that the Australian voice became more legitimised. And this is also what Fugard did for South African theatre. And this play was an interesting mixture of politics, because the characters in the play were discarded people. They were people who'd been of coloured people. People in South Africa, which in the apartheid race classification meant people of mixed race. And then they had this Group Areas Act where people of different races had to live in different areas. And these people had transgressed and their shacks were bulldozed. And they end up a night on the mudflats of this river. And it's basically a love story between, an abusive love story between an angry man who drinks too much and his long-suffering, very strong wife. So anyway, that was my first encounter with the Athol Fugard play, and I became a great fan afterwards. And then got to meet him because he was actually acting in that play with Yvonne Bryson. So he was an actor, director, and a writer. And he used to bring his plays from Port Elizabeth, which is where he was based, to Grahamstown, which is where I was as a student. And so I used to see quite a lot of the work he did with a group called the Serpent Players. And two of his famous collaborators and actors were John Carney and Winston Shawner, who were members of the Serpent Players. And so I got to meet Athol Fugard at cast parties after opening nights, you know, when people were drinking cheap wine and chatting. And so that was also a contravention of the Group Areas Act. Well, particularly, you were not allowed to drink alcohol together. You could be together, but there was a law that prohibited people of different races consuming alcohol together, which is kind of rather stupid. And I remember in the 60s, lots of these, the political types, you know, they were mixing socially, but if the security police were around, then they always had a plan B to get rid of the alcohol and hide the alcohol as quickly as possible.
Now, I think it's true, Anthony, that in that original production you saw of Busman and Leona, it wasn't possible for a black person to perform in that because of the apartheid laws. There had to be actually a white person playing a black actor. But later on, in the shows you saw at the Serpent Players, black actors could perform. What's that contradiction about? Can you unpack what's going on there?
Oh, they had some stupid laws. But it was true that at first, when Busman and Leona was done, you couldn't have mixed cast. You couldn't have audiences that were racially integrated. So there were lots of kind of complicated things. But when Athol did Busman and Leona, the guy, because there's a black character who doesn't really speak, he just mumbles. He comes onto the... So he's the third character. Quite often in Few Gods, two-handers, you always have the third character, even if he's not presence, he could be an offstage presence. And it's a device he, you know, device sounds a disparaging term. That's not what I mean. But it would be like that. And the black character had to be played by a white man who blacked up his hands and wore a balaclava, etc., because of the those crazy race laws. But when the Serpent Players came from Port Elizabeth, the casts were entirely black and they were playing to... possibly a mixed audience, but it was a university theatre. So as long as tickets were not sold and the security police were around to make sure that you only had a silver collection, it was okay. But, you know, from the early 70s, people tried to, and Athol Fugard was one of those people in the forefront, to try and make it possible to have mixed race performances and mixed casts. And he did a lot. He was quite a pioneer in that. In that sense. And there was a theatre called the Space Theatre, which was started in Cape Town in, I think, 1972, where Sizwe Banzi was first performed. And the man who started the theatre, called Brian Asprey, was the husband of Yvonne Briceland, who acted in Busman and Leona and many of Athol Fugard's plays until she died rather young. She was perhaps the signature Fugard actress. Mm.
And where did he learn his politics? When did he develop the courage or the insight to challenge the apartheid, which was the ocean in which he, you know, swam, presumably, in his early life?
Well, he did say that when he was in the Merchant Navy, there were people of different races on the ships. And I think that's when he had much more contact with people of different races. But in South Africa, there is always a kind of intimacy between white and black people, even during the apartheid era. I mean, although it was legislated that it shouldn't be, you know, you had black women working in your house as nursemaids, etc. So, you know, white kids were nursed by black women. And Athol Fugard wrote a play when he deals with this particular subject in a way called Master Harold and the Boys. It was first put on, I think, in about 82. And it was set in the... his mother ran a tea room, a kind of cafe that sold tea and scones, etc., in a park in Port Elizabeth. And Athol had a relationship with the waiters there. And there was one waiter who was a kind of surrogate father to him because his father was a bit of a deadbeat, in a sense, and certainly in that play. And I think Athol probably learnt a lot of his politics through his interaction with black people like that. And then perhaps later, when he was at university or afterwards, he would have met quite a few people who were on the political left. It was in those days, you were a leftist if you were anti-racist.
And how did he pay his bills during this time? I mean, there he is at odds with the government of the day, challenging the government of the day, a hostile environment, I guess you'd say. First of all, he doesn't get closed down, which is interesting, but also he's able to pay his way. Where's the money coming from?
He probably had a hand-to-mouth existence. I remember when I first heard about Athol Fugard, and I wasn't a drama student then, I was rather misguidedly doing a law degree, and this friend of mine said, you know, my mother's friends with Athol Fugard's wife. I said, who's he? And he said, no, he's a playwright and lives in Port Elizabeth. And he said, they're so poor, they can't even afford a fridge. Well, from my middle-class perspective at that time, you know, if you didn't have a fridge, you were in trouble. But I'm sure that once he started doing, you know, when he started out, he wrote The Blood Knot, I think his mother supported them. You know, they were living in his mother's house.
I mean, he was a big name by then. He really was one of the white faces of the anti-apartheid movement, even though you say he wasn't politically closely aligned. He was seen as part of the movement for change. And I have read that he was supported financially by people in the USA, particularly Yale University. So money was coming in.
Yes, absolutely. Late Later he did. He had, during the 1980s, I think many of his plays premiered in America before they came to South Africa. I think that for almost a decade, it was until My Children, My Africa, 1989, it opened at the Market Theatre. And it was about the first play to had its world premiere in South Africa for almost a decade. And that's because he was also getting financial support. And quite early on, his plays, well, A, because people liked the content, he was providing parts for black actors as well. And the plays were small and economic to put on. He, at one point, America always has this curious thing when they say that so-and-so's the most performed playwright after Shakespeare. And that honor went to Athol Fugard at least once, you know, to be the most. I'm sure that many, many universities, small towns were doing his plays. So I'm not sure how often they're done nowadays, although a friend of mine who lives in Toronto said that recently, I think last year, they did a revival at Cesar Bonzi Is Dead. So the players, you know, are getting revived.
What about in South Africa? Is he still a force in South Africa?
He started rehearsing his last play just before COVID broke out. And then, of course, that put everything on hold, the lockdown. And about 2 years ago, that play, again about derelict people, I saw a little bit about it on TV and or read about it in the press. It didn't sound like his best work. But I think, you know, look, he's written some great plays, but you can't expect a guy to hit a bullseye every time. You know, if you look at Tennessee Williams, you'll remember Cat in the Hot Tin Roof and Streetcar Named Desire, etc. And then you might be hard pushed to remember The Glass Menagerie. But what other great plays did he write? And I think Athol has written, in my book, you know, Busman and Leona, and a play called A Lesson from Aloes, which was a political play in a sense, but it's a very human play. It's a human story. And I think an important thing to say, to mention is that Athol once said, and he repeated this often, he said he was faced with a critical choice as a writer when he was writing about injustice. He said, either I draw my energy from hatred of the system or from love of the victims of that system. And he said, what I've tried to do with my writing is keep love alive. And that's the kind of important thing. So it's love for the victims, love for the characters, not kind of plays that were agitprop that would be, singing aggressive songs and, you know, bring down the government type of stuff. So that was his stance. That was his approach.
Yeah. Well, Anthony, it's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you for helping us remember Athol Fugard.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, it was an honour, a privilege.
Anthony Ackerman is 76. He's an award-winning South African writer for stage, radio and screen. His play Leading Ladies won the 2021 Writers Guild of South Africa Muse Award for Best Theatre Play Script. And Anthony was remembering the South African playwright Athol Fugard, who died earlier this year at the age of 92. Nice to have a chance to hear that one again. Well, it's time to bring down the curtain and turn out the lights and prepare the space for next week when the stage show is entirely devoted to Shakespeare in his most playful moods and at his most terrifying. The stage show is produced by Rosa Ellen for you to enjoy on the radio or whenever you like on the ABC Listen app or on Channel 26 on your TV. Does anyone really listen to the radio on their TV? Seems a strange thing to do. I'm Michael Cathcart. I'll see you next time we talk about the theatre here on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.